Thank you very much for joining us today on Lit Radio Podcast. I'm very excited to say that today we are joined by Nicholas Yanni, the author of Leader as Healer. And Leader as Healer recently won Business Book of the Year 2023 at the Business Book Awards. The title also won in its category Leadership Book of the Year. Today, Nicholas is going to be interviewed by Sally Dunsmore. Sally is the co-founder and director of FT Weekend Oxford Literary Festival and consultant to His Majesty's Government of Gibraltar on Gibraltar International Literary Festival. She also co-founded the Blenheim Powers Festival of Literature, Film and Music. So Sally, over to you.
Thank you, Taya. It's a great pleasure to introduce and talk with Nicholas Yanni today about his book, Leader as Healer. Nicholas is an exceptional visionary and leadership coach, working with international companies across the world from diverse sectors, both public and private. His transformative work brings together the creative, personal, spiritual, and professional development that is both powerful and systemic. As three times nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, Dr. Silly Elworthy said about Leader as Healer, the skills of deep listening, empathy, inclusivity, and compassion are now recognized and used by those making the wisest decision in politics, the military, economics, law, and justice, as well as in business. These are the skills required if humanity is to survive. This book tells you how to access them. Welcome, Nicholas. And I believe there are congratulations in order. You've won the Leadership Book of the Year and overall Business Book of the Year at this year's Business Book Awards. How do you feel about that, Nicholas? It must have been very exciting for you.
Well, first of all, thank you, Taya, and thank you so much, Sally, for being here with me. I was already really thrilled to win the category, the leadership category. I didn't expect to do so. And I was beyond thrilled and frankly a bit amazed to win the Book of the Year. So, of course, I'm very personally satisfied by it. And yet I take it in a much bigger context in a way, because I take it as an incredible affirmation and recognition of the work that I and others are bringing, which has a very radical edge to it. It is a kind of statement of correction of the prevailing mindset. We are saying that simply doesn't work anymore, and it needs not just a little bit of development, it needs a major upgrade. So I feel that the award was a major sustaining kind of wave of that work, and that's really the most important thing for me.
Well, that's wonderful. And it's lovely that people are now beginning to recognise that, because as you say, the work that you are doing is not only vital, but it does require a different way of looking at the world and a different way of behaving and a different style of leadership, because as you say, it's currently not really working the way it is as is present. And so what do you believe the significance is for management and leadership and even for business in general as Leader as Healer winning the best Business Book Award? How will the new thinking that you are bringing to this can move forward with people who are now beginning to understand what you're suggesting is important, and in fact is important for the way ahead, and as Silla Elworthy said, for humanity to survive and live well together?
Well, you know, my starting point, whether I'm working with a senior executive one-to-one or teaching at the top business schools, or indeed I've been working for the last year with the world's number one law firm, the starting point is always the same, which is that we have normalized a way of behaving, being, thinking, and engaging with the world and each other that is probably at around 20% of our real capacity. And that 20% has come to be chronically dominated by left brain thinking, that we reduce everything to thinking. And I'm a huge fan of Ian McGilchrist, who I know you know. And I think his new book, The Matter with Things, is an absolute masterpiece because he spends 1,200 pages unfolding exactly what I'm saying, that we limit ourselves, we lock ourselves into this, what I call small bandwidth of reality, and take it as being the most important. And it has major problems because our thinking mind does not feel anything. It does not experience anything. It is a narrative about everything. And I love the way Einstein asked, is your mind your master or your servant? And that's radically different. And 95% plus of the executives I work with, it's the master, meaning it's the predominant faculty. And it is a very limited way of engaging with the world, because when we are embodied, we have access to a completely different way of knowing, a completely different source of wisdom. And when we are emotionally open and connected, we have a completely different relational capacity. And all of those things also allow us access to a much higher level of intuition and a much greater capacity to relate to the complex environments we're in with all of our faculties open. We cannot reduce complex scenarios, which we are obviously more and more in. We cannot reduce them to thinking. We cannot solve them or even comprehend them through thinking alone. We have to have a much wider perceptual field. And then, you know, and this has been known for thousands of years, Sally, it's not new. Artists know this. You don't create art, you are receptive. Every artist knows this, whether it's Carlos Santana, Beethoven, they all say the same thing. Yes. You become very receptive inside, and then you start to hear. I remember reading Harold Pinter once saying that he'd be sitting writing a scene and a new character would walk in through the door. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about. We have to have access now to a much higher level of intelligence, and that will never, ever come through pure left brain thinking. And that's why I think it's so urgent now. When I teach and I make that statement about the 20%, there's sometimes a kind of shock initially, and very quickly a recognition of the truth of what I'm saying.
Because we're in the habit, aren't we, of just using the 20% and exactly. Our left brain. Yes. And it's something we're thrown to do, and society encourages us to do that. How do you then, through your work, train people to alight on the right side of the brain and bring that into the way that they operate? Because it strikes me almost going back to the beginning, to retrain yourself to move forward again.
First of all, it starts in school, as we know. And there's for quite some years now been a big movement of trying to bring in new thinking about education, because it starts in school where we're programmed into this left brain modality. So your question, I think, is very important, because it has to be an experiential process. So there are different parts of that. A very core part is working with the body, because we've come away from the body. You know, it's so interesting when people go to something like a yoga class or Tai Chi, even an aerobic class, and they walk out into the street afterwards, for at least a few minutes, sometimes more, reality is different. They experience life in a much more open, intense, multidimensional, vivid way. Now, that's just a taste. And then we go back, because actually when I ask most people I work with, so you all know that experience, everyone nods in one way or another. How much of your working day do you feel in contact with that level of openness in your body? The average is 5%. That's what we've normalized. We think that's normal. Mm. So I do a lot of very simple work with the body. It's like a resensitization. It always feels a bit like coming home. It's about breathing. It's about grounding. It's literally, energetically, a dropping down out of our thinking mind as the primary location inside into a location of I'm here as an embodied person. It's very simple. At the end of a 30 or 40 minute simple process that I do, people are usually in a completely different state. And they're sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, wow, I feel totally different right now. So, and then I teach practices. How do you maintain that? How do you develop that? Then another essential component of the work is working with our emotions. Because I think, again, we've developed a kind of chronically limited way of looking at our emotions, even through the way we call some emotions positive, some negative. No, there are just human emotions. And as I said to a group yesterday, I believe that most boardrooms are swimming in lakes of grief. Mm. And grief simply, and I know that's a simple word that has a huge implication, needs to be felt. If I am sad, I don't, and I want to get rid of it, I'm just creating huge internal tension in myself. If I can find the right circumstance, someone will simply listen to me. I can say I'm feeling sad. Sometimes that's enough. It already starts to clear. Same with fear. There is not a single person right now who inside themselves is not carrying anxiety. It's impossible given the state of the world. Now, anxiety is not something we need to get rid of. It's something we need to turn towards, feel it in our body, and then it absolutely transforms naturally. The moment we think feelings need to be changed, healed, whatever it is, we're in big trouble. We just make more and more tension inside. So this is a big rewrite, especially in corporate culture, where emotions are seen as something that, it's so stupid. They're seen as something that get in the way of thinking. And yet, the suppression of our emotions has a very adverse effect on our critical thinking faculties, because we squeeze ourselves into this little box and try and think, when 90% of our system is in a contraction. And if in the middle of a meeting, everyone would simply say, just a minute, let's just acknowledge we're tense. This is with a difficult time we're in. Let's just acknowledge we feel anxious, we feel tense, we don't sleep very well at the moment. Let's just acknowledge that. There is a huge change in the room, and we start to think much more clearly. So there is an enormous rewrite needed around emotions. Then, of course, we need to look at the fact that how much emotion is locked into us from our childhood, from our ancestral lineage as well. We carry that inside. This is now well researched in the whole field of epigenetics, for instance. So when I engage with leaders in a deeper level of work, we also engage that. And there is a whole kind of journey to be taken with our emotional biography. And I believe any leader who wants to be really functioning in their highest capacity has to do that. And it takes courage, and it takes someone providing a safe space. And I'm privileged to work with, you know, some very senior people with a remarkable level of intimacy and openness. And we face huge levels of pain in them, huge levels of terror. You know, I have worked with a couple of African-American chief executives. Deep in their body is stored terror. Mm. Because that's the imprint that their whole lineage carries. And it affects them. And it's only as we begin to feel it together, not try and heal it, but simply feel it, that it starts to dissolve in the body. So that's a whole part of the work. Another part of the work is meditation, because I've been practicing on and off for 40 years or more. And that gives us access to a very deep level of inner space, inner sense of being. And again, it moves us away from being fixated on thinking. Mm. And very often, actually, during or after a meditative practice, we have a lot of clarity of insight, same as when we're exercising. So all of this is the composition of what I would call real development work. And it really changes things. I mean, I have so many examples of how teams, boardrooms, just change once they begin. Even teams I know who start meetings now with 5 minutes silence. And there's a quote in my book from a very senior executive saying, you know, at first it was strange, but now we do it every meeting. Why? Because it increases our connection and because we have way better conversation when we start like that. Some things are so simple, it's hard to believe the stupidity of not doing them.
Also, by stepping back in that meeting, of course, gives space and acknowledgement and exactly. respect for the thing you're about to do or whatever it is you're going to discuss, rather than rushing into the meeting with the, am I late? Have I got my coffee?
Yes.
Fear, am I going to upset someone? The ego, the whole thing, I would imagine, just dispels everybody, because we're not good, are we, at just taking time to be restful and thoughtful, because somehow in today's world, that's thought of wasting time. But I think it strikes me that there's a lot of deep unhappiness in the world. For many people, not everybody in the West particularly, we have reasonably good lives. We're very busy. We're on the emails. We're got out the whole time in different ways through communications. We can do what we want, rush around. And yet for many, there's deep unhappiness. And it seems to me that disconnection between our bodies, our fellow human beings, and indeed nature and the universe is making us very sad people. And as you say, Nicholas, the way we've set up our society in terms of traditional leadership roles is simply not working. So it's very exciting to know that you were doing this work, and actually kind of a relief too, because we need it. It takes a lot of courage, doesn't it, for people to change when you've gone in with your ego and your persona and the sort of facade that you present yourself to the world, to give that up. I imagine with some of the people that you work with, not only does it take courage, but it probably makes people feel very sad in that process as well, in terms of recognizing I've been perhaps a slightly false person, but I can be this extraordinary true person and give something of myself to people in the role that I happen to have in leading a company or a group of people.
Yeah, I love how you put it. I think you're so right about the deep levels of unhappiness that get shelved. You know, they get kind of put in the cupboard because I don't have time or I don't know how to deal with that. So I plow on. And you're absolutely right that there comes a point. I think, first of all, there needs to be a recognition that something is not working. That's not so difficult to arrive at, because it's very clear that there's a lot that's not working. Then there has to be some understanding of why it's not working. And, you know, I think that's why the way I speak or my book can be very valuable, because it presents it in a very left brain, but very clear way, why are things not working? And then what's needed, you're right, it needs a certain courage, it needs commitment, and it needs a willingness to tolerate real discomfort. You know, because if I've carried a deep sadness in me since I was 5 years old, and I put it in the cupboard, at a certain moment, I'm going to need to meet that again. And the thing is, once we start the work, the discomfort part, okay, we tolerate it with more and more acceptance, because we know that even if at first an emotion feels difficult or uncomfortable, once we surrender to the feeling of it, we feel so much better.
Hmm.
So, and then what you said at the end is, I think, very important. And it's also a whole chapter in the book about purpose. You know, I'm currently working with probably the most senior person I've ever, well, one of the most, anyway. He's chair of a huge organization. And we're really looking now, I'm really asking, why are you doing what you're doing? And when he says something, I say, stop it, that's just your ego. No, I don't want to hear that. I can be very fierce in my coaching. But it's done with a lot of love. It's done with a lot of love. And he totally takes it. And then he says something else. And I say, stop. That's not a good enough reason for doing what you're doing. Let's look deeper. That's we're right on that edge with him, of me helping him, as I try to do with everyone, to figure out, who are you really? Who are you really in this world? And what are you here to do? What is the contribution you're here to make? Because you have a high capacity. And why are you compromising that? Why are you agreeing to live in a smaller version of who you really are? That's, I think, a big question for all of us. Why are we here? I frame it in two questions in the work on purpose. First of all, what is the work that is mine to do? And we probably spend our whole life living more and more deeply into that. Not the work someone told me I should do, not the work society expects me to do, not the work my parents expected me to do. What is the work I am here to do? And then the second question, which takes it in a way to a deeper level, is, what is it that is being asked of me now? Because this is far beyond the ego. This is far beyond, I want to do this, I want to do that. It's a much deeper listening to I would call it, higher dimensions of life. And can I be receptive to that? Can I follow what is being asked of me now, even if I don't really want to sometimes? And if you look at all the great artists, for instance, that's what they've always done, even when they became hugely unpopular. I think of people like Bob Dylan, Miles Davis, you know, the giants. They, at moments in their career, did what they felt called to do, even when people hated them. That's purpose. I listen to what I'm here to do, and I follow it. And I think that's also really needed now in leadership. There are far too many people in leadership positions operating from very impure motives, and it's causing a huge damage. Look at our political world, Sally. Yes. Yes. I mean, look at our political world. It's a disaster. Yeah. Where are the leaders of deep integrity, deep heartfulness, deep relational capacity, deep desire to really serve? They are few and far between.
You remind me of something that Professor Richard Dawkins said years, 20-odd years ago, at one of our festivals, which was, he said, we are the lucky ones, everyone in the room, we are lucky, because we, out of the zillions of people that could have been born, we got to be born.
Yeah.
And if you take it from that context, so we are the lucky ones, we're here, we have life. As you say, what is our deep purpose in life? Yes. Can you say something about how the soul might relate to that? Is that something within us as well as connected to the universe and other factors?
That's a very big question. And my sense of that, my understanding of that, is very much developing at the moment. Mm. Would be difficult to speak simply about that.
Yes.
Because it's such an intangible, on the one hand, it's intangible, and yet we use the word, we say, oh, she's a very soulful person, and we know what that means. So to me, let's try and put it in a certain way. Part of this narrow bandwidth I spoke of earlier is that we lose contact with the many subtle dimensions of life. And those have many different characteristics, which, for instance, in pre-industrial cultures were much more open. In pre-industrial cultures, nature spoke all the time, really, really, not as a kind of an abstract idea. The birds speak, and we've really lost contact with that. We've also lost contact with the sense of our ancestral dimensions. And we're, you know, one of the first generations in humanity that's really lost that. We don't have any sense of the dead still being with us. All of these, I simply say this because all of these are dimensions of reality that we've excluded. And I believe the what we might call the soul is also part of that. Whatever that means, our soul is an enormously rich vibrational field that is always speaking to us, and yet we very rarely seem to have the time. You said it, we're so busy. Mm. We're so busy, we don't really listen. One of the things I teach as well, because it has to be very practical, so I teach very practical techniques for how to, okay, you're going into a Zoom meeting, what do you do for a minute before that? And I teach ways of just quickly preparing yourself to be more present. These are practices. And, you know, when we want to get good at anything, sport, language, musical instrument, there is only one way, and we practice. And there is also a practice of listening more to these more subtle dimensions, like the soul. And you will find this is not so new, because if you look at the biographies of great leaders, political or otherwise, you will see they have programmed time in their week to listen more deeply. I remember reading about Shimon Peres, you know, one of the great Israeli leaders, and I believe he started every morning by reading poetry.
Oh, yes.
You know, great people, yes, and they don't allow themselves to be reduced to the minutiae of the world. They deal with that, but they're living in a much bigger dimensional reality. And the soul is very much part of that, that we have to slow down inside in order to go quicker.
Yes.
That's why I talk about when balancing being and doing, and it's not either or. We need to learn how to rest in a deep sense of inner being, however fast our doing is. That's a real skill. It's a real practice that we will deepen throughout our life if we have a commitment to that. I'm constantly discovering new aspects of what that means experientially, which is wonderful. I mean, I'm not young, and I'm learning and developing more than at any other time of my life, and I feel very, very blessed with that.
And practice, I imagine, leads to wisdom, which we would all hope to acquire in lives. And wisdom brings virtue, integrity, decency,
right,
knowing when the right thing is to be done.
Right. And fundamentally, Sally, sorry to interrupt. Fundamentally, it dissolves our sense of separateness. Mm-hmm. So because if I feel more connected to another human being, even a waiter, even a stranger, even a taxi driver, a ticket man on the train or woman, I'm going to respond to them differently. But if my heart is numb, if I'm disembodied, if I'm lost in my world of thinking, I'm not going to relate to people with a warm presence.
Mm. Yes.
So if we could say, as a fundamental part of the work of real development, is that gradually our whole sense of separateness dissolves. And if you look at every spiritual tradition, you will find that that's at the core of their teaching, that our fundamental trauma, if you like, as a species, is that we became separate from each other.
And of course, when you do have that open, warm heart, and you do have these, what might seem small exchanges, purchasing your train ticket, that warmth, then you get the warmth back, and then that sense of happiness and delight and joy. It's so small and subtle, but it just brings your day alive. And it's such a simple thing to say, but it's true. Yeah. There's a truth in
that. Because every one of us has a, even when we were babies, beyond our biological needs, our most fundamental need was to feel seen, was to look up at mother or father and have the experience of, they are feeling me, they're relating to me. And that's the same with adults. Everyone needs to feel related. And I think in leadership, if you don't understand that, then you have no right to be a leader.
So, Nicholas, what's up next? Great acknowledgement for Leader as Healer. What can we expect? What can we look forward to?
Well, one thing I'm preparing is going to be a very high-level online Leader as Healer program in the autumn, which will be over several months. And probably for a small group, 25 to 30 senior leaders, that will be an open program. And it'll be by application because we want to make sure we have the people who are really ready to do the work. So that's one big project that we're preparing at the moment. I'm deepening the work with the law firm that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. So we're about to enter a phase of really looking at purpose. And I'm excited about that. You know, if you're the world's biggest law firm, then who are you and what are you standing for?
Yes.
What
yes.
might it be like to rewrite the whole way we think about law? So I'm excited about that. I'm also preparing a different kind of program that's not only for leaders, which I call, with my dear colleague, Women and Men Healing and Awakening Together. Mm. I think that is absolutely fundamental. It's something we've not spoken about, but for me, it's also essential to understand how the archetype of the deep feminine has been absolutely exiled in our patriarchal culture. Mm. And I think that hugely needs rewriting. So that'll be a much bigger program, open to much higher numbers.
That sounds very exciting, actually.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. Mm-hmm. And I have a wonderful woman with whom I co-lead that.
So
I'm listening. I'm listening, as I said earlier. I'm listening. What is it that's being asked of me and us now?
Yes.
So it can update week by week sometimes.
Yes. And it's exciting when you hear it, isn't it?
It's very exciting.
Very exciting.
Yes, and I have a fabulous team around me. Yes. They're really the best people. And I know that all of those things I've mentioned, we can do. So.
Yes. Nicholas, it's been, as ever, wonderful to talk to you today. And thank you for telling us about Leader as Healer. You've left me feeling excited about the possibility of goodness in the world and leaders being exceptional in the way that you've described, and the opportunities for them to lead with wisdom and kindness and with authenticity and without ego. And for all those listening, I strongly encourage you to buy the book. It is an exceptional book. It is original. You can rarely say that about most things in life. It's visionary and one of those books that will enhance your life. Thank you, Nicholas.
No, thank you, Sally. It's very touching to listen to and feel your openness and your wisdom. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter, and at Lit Business Media on LinkedIn for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. We are now also on TikTok, so make sure you follow us at Lit Publishing. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.